From the boardroom to you, Voice America Business Network. It's time for Capital Thinking, where we analyze the key policy, political, legal, and business issues that will shape America's future. Live from Washington, D.C., this is your unfiltered tour of the halls of power. Now, here's your host, Kevin O'Neill.
All right, good afternoon. Welcome to this week's edition of Capital Thinking here in Washington, where we're recovering from the first snowfall of the season that paralyzed the city yesterday. For those of you keeping track on your scorecard, it took just 8 days for that post-partisan air of Barack Obama to break down. Yesterday, the House of Representatives passed the economic stimulus package on a straight party line vote. Not a single person crossed the aisle to support the president and the majority party. We'll talk more about that later. We've got a very eclectic show today. We're going to start off with a great segment, some fabulous guests. I'm joined now by Chip Smith, who's the Managing Director of Corporate Security for the Bank of New York Mellon, Pete Dowling, Senior Vice President, Operational Risk Management at AXA Equitable Life. Both these guys, retired Secret Service agents in charge in New York and D.C., so I feel very safe today. And from the legal perspective, we've got Scott Weber joining us from New Jersey. Scott is a former senior counsel to the Department of Homeland Security. So, gentlemen, welcome to the show. And, Chip, let me start with you and ask, I think since 9/11, people realize a lot of things are going on in the corporate security world where you've migrated to. We see a lot of CEOs have private protection, but the corporate security is about a lot more than just guns and guards and gates, isn't it?
Yeah, it is, and that's a very popular term all the time, Kevin, that guns, guards, and gates. But just as an example, I will tell you this. Our investigators here at Bank of New York Mellon, they are all products of, here in New York, products of the NYPD Major Case Squad, which is the law and order that everybody knows on TV. And every one of them has bachelor's degrees, and about three-quarters of them have master's degrees. So it's no longer just these, you know, the old dumb cop that you used to see out on the street back when my father was a police officer. It's moved a whole lot more into, because of the technologies, it's moved a whole lot more into all these different realms. And, you know, you wind up with IT and physical security, and you try to figure out how can we bring those together. And I think that's the biggest part of this whole thing. I really believe that they do have to come together because these new technologies start to distort some of the old boundaries. You know, you look at a laptop being stolen out of a building, and you have investigators that have to get into the who, what, when, where, why, and how, but we're also concerned about the information. So I think that's where, just a tiny example, where you see the two different stovepipes having a need to come together.
Yeah, let me ask you, Pete, let me turn to you and ask a little bit about the interaction between corporate security and business continuity programs, and maybe to sort of amplify a few of the examples of threats that the corporate security world faces these days.
Sure, Kevin. Chip just hit the nail right on the head. This, as I said to our CEO prior to taking this job, that this was about our ability to bridge a longstanding gap between the physical security element of the company and the chief information officer. And today, if you look at the threat landscape, almost everything, almost every threat that to the company from a fraud perspective may be electronic. But as you said, you know, the business continuity piece is very, very important. In the aftermath of 9/11, many, many companies, and I would tell you that Bank of New York was not one of those companies. Chip was on board there before 9/11, but many, many companies were not prepared to deal with what had happened here in New York and how it may have impacted those companies. So there was a mad scramble to staff positions in New York to take care of the one thing that everybody cared about most, and that was the health and the safety of the employees that work for these companies. My portfolio is a bit different. I have not only physical security, but I have information security and I have business continuity, privacy, and crisis management, a few other things. And, you know, this is the one thing that we constantly think about in New York City is how prepared are we? How prepared are we to take care of our employees if something catastrophic happens here in New York City? And then how do we continue business the next day? So these are very, very important questions that we ponder and discuss every single day.
We're going to talk a little bit about legal issues with Scott related to this in just a minute, but I want to ask you, I guess, you know, when I think of this, I think, boy, how many shareholders must just be livid with your board of directors, with your CEO, if you're a large company that's had maybe a bad 18 months and you're caught up in, you know, either the bailouts or just the stock has tanked. How does that, you know, not that's not all just a physical threat, but how does that manifest itself in sort of the work you do for your companies?
Well, I run operational risk management, so I have to look at these risks. I'm accountable to the CEO. I'm accountable to our shareholders through the board of directors. And one of the things that we do in our operational risk department is to look out on the horizon and identify those risks that need to be addressed and mitigated. So that's just one of the things that we constantly have to look at.
Well, and you know, too, Kevin, Pete's right. We are all accountable to everybody, but there are some inherent problems that have cropped up over this, and one of them is downsizing just in our institutions now. You know, a lot of us have to, thankfully, Bank of New York Mellon is in good shape, but we are dependent on our customers, and some of those customers are big customers. And as they cut back on their work, then it affects us in the long run. So downsizing becomes an issue where, you know, people are losing, they're not happy, some of the investors are not happy, so it's kind of easy. I saw a piece the other day that said it's very easy to, in fact, it was Steven Jobs who said it, very easy to connect the dots going forward. Not easy to connect the dots going forward, but very easy to do it backward. And
right.
That's traditional with us. That's the way we learn.
Well, let me turn to Scott for a minute and ask a question about the duty of care. And you guys certainly feel free to jump in. The duty of care that officers and directors of these companies perhaps owe to their shareholders and employees when we're talking about security. I mean, Chip and Pete have talked a little bit about who they're accountable to, but Scott, you want to look at it maybe from the legal perspective?
Sure, Kevin. The landscape has really changed post 9/11 from, as you mentioned earlier on, the guards gotten engaged to an all hazards.
Scott, can you speak up? I can't hear you, buddy.
Sure. The landscape has really changed since 9/11 from what you mentioned earlier on as the guns, guards, and gates to now an all hazards approach. And there have been some standards that have been issued by the federal government and approved by the Department of Homeland Security, in particular the NFPA 1600, that command an all-hazards approach and identify 30-plus categories of hazards. So it's not just your traditional CBRNE, chem, bio, radiological, nuclear, explosive threats. It's also cybersecurity. It's avian influenza and other pandemics. It's hurricanes. It's floods. All of that now falls under the responsibility or should fall under the responsibility of corporate security and BCP, because if any one of those hazards occur and a company is not prepared to deal with that hazard, it could ostensibly close the company down for a period of time, which if it's a publicly traded company would have the impact of a drop in the stock price, and then you have to worry about securities class action law firms coming out of the woodwork and filing class actions because the company was not prepared.
All right, well, let me turn it back to Chip and Pete, who are our resident experts kind of working in the field. Tell us a little bit about, you know, the standards that address corporate America's business continuity programs.
Well, we're accountable to regulators, both, actually more than in two areas. And, you know, on the federal side, on the state side, we have regulation. And we're also regulated by our industry, and we're constantly audited there. So, you know, we have to have viable programs in place, and what we do at my company is we constantly exercise these programs. For example, during the Republican convention in New York City, we sit right in Midtown Manhattan, a block away from Rockefeller Center, and two of the major hotels sit right at our doorstep. Protesters that would have come to New York had they targeted delegates for the convention may have closed our business down during the convention. I went to the CEO and suggested that we run the business from our business recovery site, and we did. We didn't have any problems, but at the end of the day, we had a great exercise. So what we've done consequently is exercise every year thereafter. We've done all hands-on exercises at our business recovery sites and actually run the business remotely. And by this, we can demonstrate very confidently to our regulators and to the federal entities that may be concerned, and also to people that third parties that do business with us, that we have good, viable programs and that that we can stay up in the event of an emergency or a crisis. And that also gives us a great competitive advantage in the marketplace.
Yeah, and I think, too, Kevin, adding on to what Pete said, that we are tested and audited more than I've ever seen before, and that's okay. That's all right. That's something that we need to do. But we've all built since 9/11 these redundancies in. And one of the things that we've done here, too, is to try to make the employees responsible, too, to get them to pay attention to their surroundings. And I think this is vitally important for everybody listening, that when you go into a building, whether it's for a business meeting or you're going to the movies with your family, take a look at where the other exits are. We work from rote memory all the time, where you're going out the same way that you came in. That's just the way human beings are. Know the other ways out. So we try to conduct these little symposiums and things to try to teach people there are other things you have to think about besides going in, shaking hands with a prospective client, and sitting down to do the deed. You got to pay attention to your surroundings and protect yourself, too.
And I think I'll just add on to that. Chip, you know, once again, Chip is right on the money there. Corporate security, maybe prior to 9/11, was a reactive entity. Something happened, they wanted to see you. We have a place now. We have a place now on the executive floor. We have a voice which is heard. But one of the things that we really need to do now is bring our programs to the people. Education is a huge piece of this, and people have to buy into security and buy into our crisis management programs. And once we do that and we get people engaged, it's amazing how well it can work.
Yeah, well put. And it is a sales job a lot of time.
Well, guys, I got to wrap up real fast here so we can go to commercial. Can you maybe throw out your email addresses if people wanted to get some more tips on how to start a corporate security program, pick your brain a little bit? Could we get your email addresses to do that?
Sure. I'm chip.smith@bnymellon.com.
And mine is peter.dowling, D-O-W-L-I-N-G, at AXA Equitable, EQUITABLE.com.
All right, guys, thanks for joining us. We'll be right back with more Capital Thinking.
Stocks, bonds, investment opportunities, financial news, and talk. We can help. Call us now toll-free, 866-472-5790. 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
If you find yourself under the Klieg lights of a government investigation, you want experience on your side. Patton Boggs has 46 years of it. We've handled some of the biggest white-collar crime cases. Put that experience to work for you.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Parents, did you know that high school dropouts make 42% less than graduates? Someone will have to make up that difference, and chances are, that will be you. That means paying 42% of their groceries.
Ooh, more candy.
42% of their dentist bills.
No more candy.
Even 42% of their therapy sessions.
It's all my dad's fault.
Save your money. Encourage your kids to stay in school. For help and advice, call 877-FORA-KID. A message from the U.S. Army and the Ad Council.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hear ye, hear ye. The House will come to order.
Having trouble sorting out what's going on Capitol Hill? Patton Boggs can cut through it all. We've got the insight, the know-how, the connections to navigate. Patton Boggs, straight, unfiltered. Patton Boggs, a bipartisan voice with knowledge and 46 years of experience.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
Voice America Business Network, the bottom line in business.
Live from Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattenboggs.com. That's koneill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattenboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, welcome back to Capital Thinking. Well, we're going to talk a little bit now about one of the hot issues of the new administration and Washington policymaking in general, and that is ways to reach out and connect in the 21st century, how to use digital technology to get your point across in the political spectrum. We're joined by a good friend of mine and a guy who knows an awful lot about this issue. His name's Dave Almasy. He's currently the Vice President of Digital Strategies for Wagner Edstrom Worldwide. But before he went to the private sector, Dave was the White House Internet and E-Communications Director for President George W. Bush from 2005 to 2007. Dave, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Kevin. Appreciate the invitation.
Now, I know you've got a lot of outstanding achievements. I think the one that sticks out in my wife's mind is that you're the guy who did the Barney webcam videos for the White House website, which were a tremendous success and brought a lot of sort of less casual people to the website to perhaps learn about what government's doing.
Right. Well, I mean, I can't take full credit for the creation of the Barney cam. My predecessor, Jimmy Orr, it was his idea. And it was really in the wake of 9/11 is when the idea had come up, because the ability to tour the White House at Christmas time was severely limited due to security reasons. So they were brainstorming about how to, you know, profile that and how to show Americans what the actual White House looked like. And I think it sort of came up in jest originally, and someone had just said, why don't we strap a camera to the dog and let Barney run around? And for those who don't know, Barney is the president's black Scottish terrier. And so they said, you know, it was kind of a joke, but it had gotten out to the media, and the media ran with it, and so they decided to actually do it. And so what was fun about it for me and what really presented the aha moment for me was, you know, the Internet, when I started in 2005, was still in that 1.0 realm. And by that, I mean, you know, the approach was the web was an online brochure, basically. So we publish, you read. And really the Web 2.0 evolution, what that really meant was as sites and technology started to increase, people would take content and share it beyond the site through RSS feeds, through the sharing of video, obviously YouTube, a very popular site, sites like Twitter where people are talking back and forth there as well. And so content was a lot more easily shareable. And so this all happened during my tenure there. And I really credit the Barney cam as one of my first aha moments, as I said earlier, because what happened was, you know, we had published, we finished the production, and each year, of course, the Barney cam grew, because the first year was just the dogs running around the White House and showing some B-roll of all the decorations. The second year, there was a script involved, and then I came on board, and we had some cameos. It totally grew from there. And so what happened was, once we started to tabulate some of the stats about how many people were viewing the video on whitehouse.gov, they were incredibly low. And I was very surprised about that, because I was, you know, I kept saying to the web team, wait a minute, the web is growing with such rapid rate. How come the stats on WhiteHouse.gov are so low? And then I realized it's because people were taking the video from our website and they were putting it on their own website. So you could go to WashingtonPost.com, you could go to, you know, Fox News or whatever, and they were serving up the video and they were hosting the video on their site. So we lost a little bit of control of the ability to track the stats. And then I began to realize that, is it more important that 10 million people see it on WhiteHouse.gov or 30 million people see it on all the websites that are out there? And so we started approaching, I mean, that's a fun example, but obviously, I mean, to your point, it reached a much wider audience than the average presidential speech or perhaps press briefing. But so we started approaching all of our
content. Good thing we got Barney out the door before this Screen Actors Guild strike. He might have been demanding Internet residuals from you for years to come.
Right. Well, his agent is quite busy these days, from what I understand. But
let's turn to things. I mean, see Barack Obama got a great deal of press for all of his new media initiatives. And frankly, I know that the Bush White House had a lot of these things going. They just weren't perhaps as well publicized by a fawning press. as this guy's getting now. But tell us a little bit about, if you were back in the shoes you filled in the White House right now, what would you be doing to introduce a new president to the United States via the web and all the tools you have there?
Sure. Well, I think there is a very stark difference between campaigning online and governing online. And I think this is something that a lot of people don't seem to necessarily understand. I mean, first of all, as I mentioned, sites like YouTube and Twitter and so forth and Facebook didn't really exist when I was there in 2005. I mean, Facebook was around, but it was only for college students. YouTube was just getting started, and it was before Google had actually purchased them. So, and the very early videos, for those who might recall, were, you know, dancing cats and sneezing pandas. I mean, it was like really fun, kind of silly stuff. And then I began, you know, to understand that, you know, as YouTube grew, it wasn't necessarily about the content that was there, but it was about the ability to share, you know, video via that platform.
And I don't even know who Obama girl is, but I know she's out there and she helps.
Right. Exactly. And so this is pretty much what happened on the campaign, is because you have a well-funded campaign. The Obama campaign had 95 web people. I mean, 95 people working on the website. Now, the majority of those may have been volunteers. I don't know how many were officially paid staff. But they spent, an average of about $12 million in 2 years on just web efforts alone. And to put that in perspective, you know, at the White House, our web staff consisted of six on average, and we had about $1 million a year to play with, and the majority of that were salaries. So our budgets were much smaller. But I also think that, you know, so it wasn't just about resources. It's about, you know, how do you govern online? And once you start using third-party websites, well, then you start bumping up against things like privacy concerns, because these are taxpayer-funded machines, these computers, number one, and then you have taxpayer-funded salaried staff who are engaging online. And so if you're creating a Facebook page, are you violating privacy standards? Are you publishing content outside the Presidential Records Act, which means that all that information must be stored and archived as part of the National Archives and Records Administration? There's all sorts of governing principles when it comes to engaging online that I think that the Obama White House has, you know, quickly had to kind of wrap their hands around here and figure out what can we do and what can't we do. So
is that frustrating for you, Dave, where you know, the lawyers have to look everything over, but they can't possibly keep up with the pace of innovation and technology, and the law can't either to understand, give you the flexibility you want to do these things?
Yeah, I think in some ways, but in other ways, I mean, the spirit of the policy I completely agree with. And I've often told the story that, you know, in the wake of Hurricane Katrina, right after that, the president spoke in the Rose Garden, where he encouraged people to go to redcross.org to sign up and help out. And so it was a public-private partnership. And so being the dutiful Internet director that I was, you know, when the transcript came out, we put it up on the website, and I made that link clickable on the White House site to redcross.org, because the president, in fact, said, go to redcross.org, sign up, and do what you can to help. So I got a call a little while later saying, you got to take the link down. And I said, well, what do you mean? They said, well, you can't link to a nonprofit organization from a government site because it appears that we're endorsing them. I said, well,
have you endorsing the Red Cross, Dave?
Well, I mean, the point was that, you know, there are a lot of other, you know, very charitable organizations out there, and how do you decide who you endorse and who you don't? And it's actually against the law for anyone to profit from the federal government or to receive endorsement. And so I said, yeah, but the president said, and they said, yeah, but you know what? He's a private citizen, so he can basically do whatever he wants. But you're using taxpayer-funded machines here and resources to publish this content. And the point that they made, which I didn't think about, is when that site's archived, so today, for example, if you were to go to that transcript from, you know, way back when, and you click on redcross.org, it'll take you to the homepage of the Red Cross today, which obviously will have a number of different issues up there, probably very few of them related directly to Katrina.
Well, so, hey, let me ask you this. We've got a couple minutes left here before the break.
Sure.
Obama had a digital army of supporters
that
he's got some limits on. He can't take them inside the walls of the White House, but he's talked a lot about how he wants to reach out to them to help them advocate and agitate perhaps Congress to push for the changes that he promised out on the campaign trail. If you were in those shoes, how would you be doing that?
Well, I don't think you can do it from the White House. I think there's a fine line between, you know, federal and political, and I think you'd have to motivate folks outside of that, whether it's a campaign that's set up as a separate 501c3 or whether it's the DNC operating it. But, you know, you need to be really careful about, how much political, you know, arm strength you use, because you have to understand that WhiteHouse.gov isn't just for the 52-some percent of the people who voted for him. It's for the entire American people and international audience as well, so that people can keep track of what the President of the United States is doing in his official capacity. So, you know, my advice would be is, you know, obviously you can't fully put up a huge wall between, you know, the official duties and the political ones, but you need to be pretty careful about it so that you're not mixing the two so that it actually becomes inappropriate.
And let me put you in your shoes now here in the private sector. Knowing what you know about how the government operates in the digital realm, what are some of the keys you say to perhaps groups that are trying to use these new mediums to get their message out and to have their members and supporters reach out to policymakers and say, hey, this is a good idea, or block that?
Yeah, well, I think ultimately it's just about the tools that are available. Educate yourself about, you know, how do you share information? How do you build community is really what it's about. You know, there's way to interact online and there's way to interact offline, and it's very similar. And so, you know, you'll see, for example, you know, GOPleader.gov, which is the John Boehner's website. You know, they're doing some great things on YouTube, and they actually yesterday just did kind of like a day in the life of the minority leader, which was really interesting, particularly with all the debate about the stimulus package on the Hill yesterday. So it was an interesting, you know, glimpse into a behind the scenes that we probably couldn't have seen 3 to 4 years ago. So I think, you know, think about how do you tell your story digitally and what platforms do you publish that in, so you can literally send a link out to bloggers or other folks online who are sharing information in Facebook or Twitter to really help augment your message.
And tell me, Dave, how do we get a hold of you? I mean, you must be on Facebook. Are you Twittering? What are some of the places we can find you to share your wisdom?
You can find me on Facebook. On Twitter, my Twitter name is Almacy. So if you go to twitter.com/ALMACY or at Almacy, the at sign Almacy is how you actually send someone a reply on Twitter. And also I have a blog, capitalgig.com, which I wish I could publish a little bit more often. I've got more blog posts in my head than are actually on the website, I tell people. But yeah, so you can reach me through any of those ways,
and even email and old fashioned telephones, I'm sure as well. Hey, I got 30 seconds. Any quick breaking new political things?
You know, nothing that's really coming out of the gate so far. I would just keep an eye on WhiteHouse.gov and see how it grows. I encourage people to get involved.
Dave, thanks so much for joining us. We're gonna be back in just a minute with another segment of Capital Thinking.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
What's your name worth? The loss of a single patent, trademark, or copyright can cost millions. Make sure your intellectual property is protected. Trust Patton Boggs to manage and protect your most important assets.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hey, out of my way!
Welcome to Washington Gridlock. Patton Boggs' legal team can make sense of it all. We know how Washington works. We've been sorting it out for the past 46 years. We have what it takes. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs. We deliver the insights you need to stay on top of your game.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Hola.
Konnichiwa.
Bonjour.
Hello.
From Anchorage to Abu Dhabi.
Marhaba.
From Denver to Doha.
Ciao.
Patton Boggs makes business transactions the world over.
Oi.
Rely on our insights for your next deal. Patton Boggs, the international business team. Straight, unfiltered, Patton Boggs.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
business community's first choice in Internet Talk Radio. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, we're back on Capital Thinking. And if you're like me, part of the downturn, the economic downturn, has you incredibly worried about the state of your financial situation, be it your mortgage and whether or not you're underwater or above the high water mark on what you owe on that house, how it's appreciating, how your stock portfolio is down. I have one friend who was excited because his portfolio was down a mere 25% last year. And everybody else was in the 30s and 40s. We were actually jealous of him only losing 25 cents on the dollar. And we all see perhaps a large wave of litigation coming that could threaten all of us on various levels. And so we wanted to bring on today an expert in wealth preservation, estate planning, tax issues, and proud to have Jim McNair, a partner at the law firm of Patton Boggs in McLean, Virginia, who's joining us for the rest of the show. Jim, welcome to the show. How are you today?
I'm well, thank you, Kevin. Thanks for inviting me to join your show today.
Yeah, welcome to your maiden voyage here on Capital Thinking. Now, let me start out. We're going to get through a bunch of different topics, and, of course, if folks want to call in or email us a question, we'd be delighted. We've got plenty of time to take it and respond to it today. But let me ask you again, as I was saying, you know, given this current state of the economy, we got people concerned that creditors, plaintiffs, or lots of different people may be coming to attach their assets as individuals. Where do you start your dialogue with people who are seeking to protect their assets from creditor claims?
Well, it's a relatively big picture. First of all, you have to understand exactly what claims someone is concerned about. For example, if it's a claim against the individual and the individual wants to protect his assets from his claim, then that's much more problematic than if the individual is seeking to set aside assets for the benefit of a child and wants those assets protected from claims. So the first step is to figure out what's the nature of the claim and who's it asserted against. So let's assume that we're talking about an individual and we're talking about claims he's concerned about and protecting his assets from those claims.
Yeah, we can use me as an example if you want. Married, two kids, decent job, not too many creditors, I like to think.
So the creditors are breathing down your neck, Kevin, and you're wondering what you can do. The first question...
I'm not answering my phone at home right now.
All right. So one thing you could do is you could seek to transfer assets from your name to the name of your wife or to a trust for your children. Before doing that, you'd have to take into account a couple of things. First of all, if you make a transfer of assets that results in a fraud on your creditors, then that may be criminal. Furthermore, you can subject yourself, you can subject transferees, you can subject your attorneys, your accountants, and other people to liability to the extent they participate in a fraud on your creditors. So you need to be very careful to make sure that doesn't happen. So before you set about transferring assets, what you need to do is develop a realistic idea of what those claims are. So if you met with your lawyers, you met with anybody you're involved with, and you determined that the amount of your claims realistically is $500,000, then you can set aside $500,000 that you would keep available to satisfy those claims, and you can transfer your other assets to your creditors. By doing it that way, then the transfer of the excess assets wouldn't be fraudulent.
Okay. And what's the upside to me of making that transfer in that instance?
It may well be that when your lawyers and other advisors determine that the amount of your exposure today is $500,000, you're sort of putting an upper limit on what your loss could be if you transfer the remaining asset someplace else.
I see. Okay. Now, you mentioned fraudulent conveyance. There's been a lot of attention paid in the last week or so to one of these guys. I don't want to say it's Bernie Madoff, but it's one of these financial executives who seems like he's about to face some large-scale litigation for his role in people who lost money, who down in Florida transferred a very nice estate of several buildings on the beach to his wife for a sum of $100 in December. That sounds to me like it might be an issue. And so can you walk us through the mechanics of me transferring assets to my wife? I'm sure my wife is listening right now, taking notes, figuring out how she can get a hold of the assets she doesn't already have firm control of.
Well, if she's like my wife, she's got control already.
That's right.
So the question there is, number one, would a transfer to a spouse result in a fraudulent conveyance? The answer is, if as a result of the transfer, you're insolvent, you can't afford to pay your debts, or if as a result of the transfer, your creditor's ability to attach assets is severely hindered or delayed, then that's a fraudulent conveyance. Again, to the extent that this person down in Florida made a transfer of valuable assets for $100 to a spouse, that's likely a fraudulent conveyance, and it's likely something that the creditors can unwind. Now, let's assume that you've done this personal credit analysis and determined that if you keep $500,000, you can transfer the rest of your assets. In that event, number one, if you wanted to transfer assets to a spouse, probably the safest thing to do would simply be to change the title to assets from being in your name alone to being in the name of you and the spouse as tenants by the entireties. The nice thing about that is it's simple, it's easy, it's straightforward, it's virtually foolproof. So to the extent that assets are held as tenants by the entireties, then those assets cannot be attached by the creditor of one spouse alone.
Are there gift tax liabilities that are sort of implicit in some of these transactions if I have enough net worth involved?
Absolutely. A transfer of an asset from you alone to you and your spouse as tenants by the entireties affects a gift of 50% of the asset to your wife. Fortunately, there is an unlimited marital gift tax exclusion. So therefore, you know, if you've got $10 million in assets, you can transfer half of that to your wife and subject yourself to no gift tax liability.
Well, she would say I could transfer all of it to her, Jim.
Absolutely, she would, and she'd be right. You could transfer all of it to her without gift tax liability. That addresses another issue we can raise in a moment. But to follow on from your question, if you were to transfer assets to her in trust, you might prefer to transfer assets to her in trust because to the extent that you retain certain powers over the trust, then even though she's a beneficiary, you haven't completely let go of those assets. That could provide you personally a greater measure of protection. However,
a
transfer...
Sounds like I might even have a chance of getting some of my money back if I put some strings attached to it.
That's the problem. To the extent that you put too many strings into the trust agreement, then the transfer to the wife in trust may not qualify for the gift tax marital deduction and could be a taxable transfer.
Now,
any transfer of more than $1 million to your wife to a trust that doesn't qualify or to anyone else in the world would subject you to gift tax liability at 45%.
That's a hefty little rate these days. Let me ask you this. If, God forbid, after I transfer my assets to my wife, she decides that I've seen my best days and she wants to dissolve our union, what are my chances of reclaiming some of that money?
You're screwed, sir. Yes, with the divorce rates today and the 50% rate, it's more likely that you're going to go through, not you personally, of course, Kevin, but it's more likely an individual is going to go through a divorce during his lifetime than an insolvency proceeding and creditor's rights proceeding. So to transfer assets to your spouse, I've got a number of clients who in the late 1990s had significant problems with creditors and decided the best thing to do was transfer all the assets to their spouse. Well, that significantly changed the power relationship between husband and wife. And husbands who were relatively footloose and fancy-free became much more guarded and circumspect in their social activity once all the assets belonged to the wife.
Sure. I can see that. Well, we've talked a lot about wives. I guess let me ask you, are there any different implications? I've got two kids. If I transfer some of these assets to children who are minors and perhaps even of an age where legally they couldn't even be a party to a contract or, I've got a two-year-old. Surely she's going to take whatever I give her, but she's not going to be able to, be a participant in the discussion about why I'm transferring it to her.
Again, if you transfer assets to a trust for the benefit of your daughter, The benefit of that is that those assets can be protected from her creditors. Those assets can be protected from a divorce that she marries sometime after she's 2 years old.
She's not going to marry. She's going to a convent. She's never going to be dating.
She'll be there with my daughter. So those assets will be protected from divorce. They're protected from the claims of creditors. However, if you transfer more than $1 million in assets to that trust, then you're going to be subject to a 45% tax.
Well, first I wish I had $1 million to transfer. Then I could worry about the 45% tax here. Jim, I got time for one more question. We're going to take a break here in about 2.5 minutes. But let me ask you, you know, are there steps a couple can take if they're not subject to an immediate creditor claim, but we're sort of looking down the road? We have a long-term desire to insulate ourselves, protect our assets from potential liability.
And yes, in fact. This is a technique that we employ for a number of our clients. A lot of our clients are healthy today from a financial perspective, but they're concerned that somewhere down the road things could change. They want to provide themselves a measure of financial security, and they want to try to find a way to exclude those assets not only from the claims of creditors but also from estate tax liability. So there are techniques that we've developed whereby the husband can set up a trust for the wife, and he can sell assets to that trust in exchange for a promissory note or other sort of payment right. And then the wife can set up a trust for the benefit of the husband, and she can convey assets to that trust in exchange for a grantor retained annuity, a series of annuity payments over a fixed period of time. Then for the next several years, each spouse will be entitled to a series of payments from those different trusts so that the value of the spouse's estate is made whole as a result of the payments back. Then 4 or 5 years down the road, the trusts will own those assets free and clear, and there'll be no fraudulent transfer, no fraudulent conveyance. And as long as the trusts are substantially different, for example, the wife might set up a trust for the husband alone, the husband might set up a trust for the benefit of the wife in future generations. There could be difference in provisions about distribution. The trust cannot be reciprocal and identical. But to the extent that there are substantial differences, then both trusts should be respected, and the assets held by both trusts should be protected not only from claims of creditors but also from estate tax.
Jim, let me cut you off there. We're going to come back with you more questions after the break. You're listening to Capital Thinking on the Voice America Business Network.
Markets up or down, or if you're looking to improve your portfolio, our experts are ready to talk to you. Call now, toll free, 866-472-5790. That's 866-472-5790. Voice America Business Network.
The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
From K Street to Wall Street to LaSalle Street, the Patton Boggs team knows how to pull off big business transactions. Come hear what we know. Patton Boggs covers the world.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
Interrogatories.
Prima facie.
Pleadings.
Motion for summary judgment.
E-discovery.
Affirmative defense.
Stipulations.
Ex parte.
Amicus brief.
Subpoena.
Litigation is confusing. Trust the litigation team at Patton Boggs to make sense of it all.
Stewart Pape Attorney at Law is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000. The following is a paid advertisement from Patton Boggs, LLP.
The same firm that's been navigating the government maze for more than four decades is also the same firm that can help you protect your most important assets. Whether it's a valuable patent, an important copyright, or your next big idea, Patton Boggs is committed to protecting your intellectual property.
Stuart Pape, attorney at law, is responsible for the content of this ad. Patton Boggs' principal office is located at 2550 M Street Northwest in Washington, D.C., 20037. You may contact Patton Boggs at 202-457-6000.
When it comes to business, you'll find the experts here. Voice America Business Network.
From Washington, it's Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. Join us on the program and weigh in on the topics discussed with your question or comment. The toll-free number is 1-866-472-5790. That's 1-866-472-5790. You can also direct your questions or comments via email to koneill@pattonboggs.com. That's K-O-Neill, O-N-E-I-L-L, at pattonboggs.com. Now, back to Capital Thinking.
All right, I'm Kevin O'Neill. You're listening to Capital Thinking. I'm joined by Jim McNair, the law firm Patton Boggs here in the Washington, D.C. area. Jim McNair has been named one of Washington's top trust and estates lawyers by the Washington Business Journal last year, and we've been talking about how to protect your assets in these troubled times. Jim, let me turn a little bit. You know, when I get together with my friends and we're sort of cringing and crying about things, you know, you hear a lot of folks my age who seem to have what I used to think were sort of exotic setups where they had limited partnerships or LLCs that they had poured a lot of their personal assets, their small businesses in. You know, it sounds sort of complex, but I'm wondering if you can talk a little bit about how vehicles like that have the ability to help people protect their assets going forward.
Absolutely, Kevin. If you and I, Kevin, went out and made an investment, so you and I decide that we want to buy a rental property together. So we go back to your hometown of Virginia, Vienna, Virginia, and we buy a rental house. And then we find a tenant for that house, and we hope it goes up in value over some period of time. If we own that house as tenants in common, so that you own part of the house and I own part of the house and we own it together, then if I later get myself in trouble with a bunch of creditors and those creditors want to come and attach those assets, my assets, the creditor can attach my half of the rental property that you and I own together. So when you started off thinking that you were going to have this wonderful, great, good-looking partner in Jim McNair, and later I went south creditor-wise, and now you own half the property with a bank or some other owner.
People warned me about investing with you, McNair.
Right. It turned out not to be as good as you hoped it was going to be. But under those circumstances, the creditor can come take my half of our joint asset. On the other hand, if you and I formed an LLC and you and I caused that LLC to buy the rental property so that what you owned was a piece of the LLC and what I owned was a piece of the LLC, then the creditor could not come and attach the rental property. Instead, all the creditor could do would be go to court and get an order that directs our LLC to make a distribution to the creditor the next time the LLC was going to make a distribution to me. Well, that would give us all sorts of opportunities. First of all, you know, the LLC could decide not to make distributions. So the LLC could hold on to those assets, continue to manage those assets, and protect those assets from claims. So as you can see, using an LLC or a partnership as a vehicle to own and manage assets gives you an ability to protect the underlying assets from the claims of creditors.
Gotcha. Well, I want to get a couple more questions here in our last few minutes. Talk to me about how I can protect my child's assets should he or she actually develop creditors between now and the time they achieve majority age.
But if your son is anything like mine, and I love him dearly, but I'm a little concerned about some of his judgment. And what I plan to do, in fact, what I have done, is I intend to leave his estate, not outright to him. Instead, I will leave his share of my assets to a trust for his benefit. And that trust will designate a trustee, and the trustee will have discretion to make distributions in the best interest of my son. As a result of that, if my
son gets
himself in
trouble, Corvette probably
wouldn't
be defined as in his best interest.
Excuse me?
I said getting a new Corvette wouldn't be defined as in the trustee's best interest, right?
Well, it kind of depends how much money's in there, but based on how much money I think will be in there, there'd be no money for Corvettes. So the trustee would then manage the assets for my son and would use those assets in his best interest. If by doing it this way, then regardless of however improvident he may be, the money I leave for him will be protected, and that money will be available to him and his wife and children for the long term. Now, with my daughter, of course, is perfect. So in her case, I'm a little less concerned about her being improvident, and I might name her to be a co-trustee of her trust. That would give her more control over her trust than my son would have over his. The problem with that, though, is that the more control I give her, then the less protected those assets are from the claims of her creditors.
Right. That sort of undermines the whole point of the exercise, right?
Of course, with her being perfect, the likelihood of her having creditors' problem is much less, and I'm less concerned about it.
Well, I'd hate to be the two of them after you've moved on and, you know, they're comparing things at the reading of the will and discover that you liked her more than you liked him, and he's in a lot of trouble. He's got this mean Uncle Vito who's going to oversee the distribution of his assets for the next 20 years, and she's skipping off to the mall with her share.
You know, I like them equally, but, you know, they're different people.
Exactly. Fair enough. I think that's a great insight. I would not have thought of that. Well, let me just kind of skip overseas, if you will. I'm not familiar with the term that I've been reading a little bit about, sort of foreign asset protection trusts. I know a lot of us have more and more investments overseas, whether it's stock funds or even hard assets like real estate and whatnot. Tell us a little bit about those types of trusts.
Sure. For years, a number of jurisdictions, the Cayman Islands, Bermuda, Isle of Man, Switzerland, have offered asset protection trusts. These are trusts that you can set up for your benefit. So you put assets into the trust, you're a trustee of the trust, or you're not a trustee of the trust directly, but you have some influence over the trustee, and you're a beneficiary of the trust. Your children and grandchildren are the long-term beneficiaries of the trust. Under the laws of those jurisdictions, as long as typically a year and a half or 2 years pass after you put the money into the trust, then those assets will no longer be the subject of claims of your creditors. So if you're wealthy today and you transfer assets into the trust today, and then 5 years from now you get yourself into a pickle with creditors, then those creditors cannot attach the assets held by those foreign trusts.
Nice. Interesting. Well, I got about 2 minutes left. Let me hit one last subject with you. It's my understanding a couple of states, Delaware, which I think is no surprise, but also Alaska, which maybe is a little bit of a surprise to me, are letting people establish asset protection trusts. What do you think about that? Do I have to be a Delaware or Alaskan citizen to take advantage of that?
I'd like to just sort of add one more point of clarification to the last point. That is that the way I left it there, it sounded like these foreign creditor protection trusts were really neat vehicles. The problem, though, is that to make those trusts work, they have to be funded with completely non-U.S. situs assets.
Oh.
There's a number of cases where U.S. citizens funded those trusts and then had creditor issues, and then the courts would hold the grantor of the trust in contempt and let them reside in jail until they gave direction to the trustee to distribute assets back out. The reason for that is it's against public policy in almost every U.S. jurisdiction for you to set up a trust for your own benefit to the detriment of your creditors. As you noted a moment ago, Alaska and Delaware have passed new rules which would allow you to set up a trust for your own benefit if it's in Alaska or Delaware. And, you know, as a general rule, we've got this concept in the U.S., which is full faith and credit. Every other state has to pay attention and recognize the rules passed by a different state. The problem with this is that that's not true to the extent that the laws of another state are in conflict with the basic public policy of a different state. So in Delaware and Maryland, the two jurisdictions are side by side. In Maryland, it's against public policy for you to set up a trust for your benefit to the detriment of your creditors. So if you live in Maryland, you go to Delaware and set a trust up for your benefit, and then you've got creditors in Maryland, it's unlikely that the Maryland court is going to respect the Delaware trust. On the flip side, if you live in Delaware and you set the trust up in Delaware and all the assets are in Delaware and you never leave Delaware, and your Delaware creditors would be frustrated.
And what about Alaska?
Same thing in Alaska. Alaska basically copied Delaware.
Well, Jim, I really appreciate you joining us. Folks, if you want to get in touch with Jim, his email address is kmcnair@pattenbogs.com. We'll be back next Thursday with another great episode of Capital Thinking. Until then, keep it locked here on the Voice America Business Network.
Thank you for joining us for Capital Thinking with your host, Kevin O'Neill. We hope to have you join us again for more insight from Washington. We're here every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific Time, noon Eastern, on the Voice America Business Network.